So our speaker is Finney Prem Kumar. He's an independent scholar and founder of Truth Matters, based in Birmingham, UK. And Finney will be speaking on convergence of the human and divine, the metaphysical limitations of science and its implications for theological reflection. Quick request, for recording purposes, we have a microphone at the front here. Later during the question discussion time, if you could just speak forcefully, strongly, so that the mic in front can pick you up, that'd be very helpful for the tech team.
Thank you. Well, I just want to thank the ASA for this immense privilege, and I want to thank the previous two speakers for their contribution to the ongoing dialogue. Both of them spoke about creation and the natural order of things, and I just want to start with something humorous along those same lines. So this young man had just graduated from college, and he looked up to the heavens, and he was feeling rather smart, and he looked up to the heavens and he said, "You know, God, if I had your capacity, if I had your infinite wisdom and your knowledge, I would have designed the world slightly differently." And he began to point out all the flaws in creation. And he looked up the heavens and he said, "For instance, look at the big tall oak tree that I'm sitting under. It's bearing only small little nuts. But this small plant right here is bearing huge watermelons. It makes absolutely no sense in terms of design. Big tall oak tree, small little nuts, small little tree or small little plant bearing huge watermelons." As he kept on waxing eloquently about the flaws in God's creation, a small nut fell from the tree and hit him on his head. He looked up and said, "Thank God that wasn't a watermelon." You know, I have found out that sometimes the things that we take to be normative turn out not to be so. And so with that in mind, I want to talk about the area of science. Something that you might not be used to, something that might be counterintuitive, but please bear with me as I go through the argument. And then I'm really looking forward to the discussions and the questions that you might have. My thinking on this converge in various ways. One of the schools of thought that I'm very sympathetic to is Reformed epistemology that was spearheaded by Plantinga and Walter Storff. And I also have a particular reading of the history of science. I say particular because I think all of our readings on different areas and matters of life, and especially in academia, are particular. We don't have a generic, overall, comprehensive view of anything. But that's just how we are constituted, and that's just what we are as human epistemic agents. And then thirdly, I'm very concerned about the role of faith, because faith is a substance and a navigating force in my life, as I'm sure it is in yours as well. So having said that, in the context of that, as I get into this talk, this is going to be a little bit different. If you have any questions that just cannot wait, if you want to make a comment and you're just itching to make that comment, please go ahead and interrupt me. I wouldn't mind that at all. If we get stuck, I'll keep moving us along, but we'll have a time for Q&A at the end. Let me begin with this picture. How would you describe this table?
Wood.
I can describe it pragmatically by saying that I can sit on this table, I can put a laptop on this table, I can do things with this table. Now let's say that I have no concept of science, I don't know anything about physics, that is probably how I describe it. Let's say that a physicist walks into the room, he looks at the same table, how do you think he's going to describe it? Maybe there is empty space, at the subatomic level it's not what it seems, electrons, the motion, the movement, and so on, right? The main thing to realize is this, usually when we look at different explanatory models, we assign weight and value to each one of them. And it so happens that most of the time, if not all of the time, we assign a certain level of depth and weight to scientific models and scientific explanations. Is that not true? We usually say that the physicist, in his explanation or in offering his explanatory model of this table, has somehow penetrated some depth of reality that the other explanations do not. That is the usual assumption. If that is the assumption, and that usually is, what are some issues that need to be addressed? Is the depth intrinsic to the explanation, or is it something that is attributed to the explanation? Is it something that emerges from the explanation? Does it self-exemplify itself as some sort of a depth or penetration into the ontological reality that we so seek to understand? Or is it something that we attribute because we can just do more things with those types of explanatory models? Secondly, are we being referential or representational? Sorry, that should have been a B. Are we being referential or representational? And the distinction between these two goes along these lines. When something is referential, and I know the reference is used in very different ways, but I'm going to use it in this sense, in the sense of being inferential and internal, in an epistemic sense, in the sense in which we know things. What do I mean by inferential and internal? Well, when we reference something, when we talk about something, when we talk about objects in terms of concepts. Our thoughts are constrained conceptually. But it's not just one concept or another. Every concept is clustered with other concepts. It's a web of beliefs built up by concepts, right? And all these concepts together provide some sense of coherence and structure. And within that structure, within that coherent framework that we have, we make the needed inferences and the references. So it stays very internal to the structures, stays very internal to the conceptual scheme or the conceptual framework. And within that conceptual schemes and frameworks, we have assumptions and unarticulated constituents. There is a tacit dimension. There are a lot of things that are not explicitly known in our cognition or in the act of cognition or in our epistemic act. When we come to know something, when we come to conceptualize something, when we cluster these concepts. And the problems with assumptions is this. First and foremost, it's very hard to identify the assumptions that we have. Secondly, even if identified, it's very hard to say which assumption has regulative power and to what extent. So these are some of the things that we usually don't think about. These are very simple things. Some of you might already, if not all of you, might already know these things, but I just want to rehearse them in order to build up my case. In this sense, even logic is a system of inference and validations and not necessarily truth tracking. Now, this might seem very alarming and very postmodern or postmodernistic, and some of you might revolt against that, but just hang in there. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to voice them. So we have this whole system, this conceptual scheme, within which validations and inferences and various referential statements are made. And these clustered concepts that come together as a whole, and they kind of connect with each other. There is no standalone concept, because we don't understand things in a generic way. We don't have a God's eye perspective or a God's eye view. Every concept is a clustered concept. Even if you forget everything else, just try to remember that. Every concept is a clustered concept. There is a buildup of concepts, and we don't even completely understand how the clustering happens or what concept really weighs in it in order to move the clustering in a particular direction. So this is what I mean by reference. What is representation? Because we said the explanation is referential or representational. Representation is when there is ontological entailment. When you're not just referencing objects within their frame of reference, when you're not just referencing a cluster of concepts, but these things are actually what the state of affairs are. So you've moved from epistemology into ontology, what you know to what is in fact the case, what is actually the state of affairs, okay? And in many ways, a lot of people argue for ontological entailment based on the things that I've positioned on the left side of the screen, the progress of science. If science is not somehow ontologically making some contact with the actual world or the real world beyond concepts and reference, then how do we progress in science? There's got to be some base level where we are touching the core aspects of reality. So that's the first argument. The second argument is the argument of mature theories. We don't just deal with the same theories over and over again. Over a period of time, we learn more, and the theories come to a maturation point, right? And so we really gather more and more as time goes on. And then this leads to the approximations of reality. Granted, we don't understand reality completely or comprehensively, but there is a sense of approximation where we're moving closer and closer to ascertaining what that reality is or what the target system is. And then we have the scientific method, which has been a proven method in many ways, a validated method. And so finally, we come to the inference of the best explanation. And I'm going through this very quickly because of the lack of time. The IBE, we look at all the evidence, we employ the scientific method, we look at observation, repetition, all these things, and we infer what the best explanation is, often called abduction. Now, the problem is this. In terms of the progress of science, how many of you have heard of the pessimistic meta-induction? It basically means that even the most confirmed of scientific theories in the past turned out to be false or turned out to be rejected, which means that even the most confirmed theories right now could potentially or possibly turn out to be false or could be rejected in some probable or potential future. Okay, so that's an argument against the progress of science somehow reaching ontological depth. Second thing, mature theories. When theories become mature, are we really penetrating the depths of reality, or are we redefining and recharacterizing and refining our vocabularies? Is it merely that the dialogue is getting better and better? Now, none of this is to disparage science, and I'll explain that later on. I'm not trying to downplay the importance of science or disparage science. I'm just trying to show some built-in limitations that science seems to exemplify, that the other disciplines exemplify, that we often overlook. Are we really refining the vocabularies? Or are the vocabularies touching reality at some point? Approximations of reality, what are we approximating? What is the real? And what is the distance between where we are and where the real is? How do we measure that? Again, these are things that we usually don't talk about. Scientific method, criteria and conceptual constraint. Is there a way in which scientific methodology conduces to truth in a non-epistemic sense? And the answer is no. Because any methodology comes under criteria and conceptual constraint. That immediately epistemizes it. Now, there's nothing wrong with it. The only problem is, once something is epistemized, what is the ontological reach or the ontological entailment? That becomes questionable. And then finally, inference to the best explanation. How do we figure out what the best explanation is? The underdetermination of theory by evidence, right? Two different theoretical frameworks can be offered as potential alternatives to the same piece of evidence. How do we determine which one we accept and which one we reject? Well, based on some assumptions that we have, based on some pre-commitments that we have that we bring to the force of investigation that moves us in one direction rather than another. Now, usually, how many of you have heard of the no miracles argument? It was forwarded by a man called Hilary Putnam in 1975. Usually, the argument, even if you could kind of overlook all the things I talked about, the argument that is forwarded in terms of scientific realism, or that science actually touches some part of reality or has ontological entailment, is the no miracles argument. And Hilary Putnam produced a very forceful version of that argument in his 1975 article. He says realism is the only philosophy that doesn't make the success of science a miracle. Again, going back to whether science touches reality or has ontological entailment because it's intrinsic or because it's attributed. What this argument really shows is that the pragmatics of science should make us come to the conclusion that science, in fact, gets things true. Empirical success of a theory T, the empirical adequacy of a theory T, comes down to the truth of theory T. What we know brings us to what is the case because of the success that we see, because of the empirical adequacy that we see. But the problem is both of these circles can be constrained conceptually within a phenomenological framework. Bas van Prasen.
I'm not following. What's the difference between adequacy and success?
They are related concepts. So success is when within the framework there is validation. Empirical adequacy is when you save the phenomenon. Okay, that's a phrase that Bas van Prasen, the constructive empiricist, used. What that basically means is that I can give you an explanation that is very adequate to the goals and the aims of science, but it doesn't necessarily mean that therefore it's true. It just means that it's adequate in terms of saving the phenomenon, the scientific phenomenon. Because as we saw, in terms of the table, you can look at it as a scientific phenomenon, you can look at it as a practical phenomenon, you can look at it as a sociological phenomenon, and then you can employ vocabularies that come within those domains or within those constraints. Okay? Oh, that's a good question. So how do we get, yeah?
So for example, like the statement, the Earth is approximately a sphere, can that be ontologically true, or is that only the best it can be is empirically adequate?
Yeah, it could be empirically adequate, yeah. And it could provide some success in terms of previous statements that were made and validated and verified. So because it happens within the inferences that are made within the framework. So it'll have coherence and it'll have self-consistency, right? Those two things. You can even have correspondence. So usually we've thought of correspondence coherence as test for truth. But I'm saying correspondence coherence are tests for internal consistency within the framework. So you can have internal validations and so on, but how it represents something outside the framework or ontologically in terms of entailment is something that is yet to be seen. So that's what I'm going to get to. But that's a good question, yeah. So how do we get to ontological entailment? Well, it seems to be that we get to ontological entailment by presupposition or postulation. Either we presuppose before the dialogue begins, or we postulate, like Hilary Putnam, after the dialogue is concluded. We presuppose certain things about reality. We make certain ontological commitments, and there's nothing wrong with ontological commitments. Ontological commitments are good things, and we all make them, but it doesn't tell us anything about the ontology that we're committed to.
Yeah. If we're working on a new investigation, we have to start somewhere. We can't start
right.
from zero.
Right.
So what's the difference between presupposition and mature theories that you were talking about? Because mature theories basically become our presupposition.
Right. It's a buildup.
We go back and look at this, we think it's true. So what's the difference?
Yeah, it's a buildup. The presuppositions constantly build up based on previous experience and previous things we have concluded. Like you said, we don't start from scratch. So it's a buildup. And all of us rely on previous knowledge, the books that have been written, the theories that have been forwarded, right? We stand on the shoulders of others, so to speak. And so we follow the tradition. So we're all, in a very real sense, tradition constituted. It just depends on which tradition we stand in. So we might, you know, based on the traditions we stand in, we might have different views. I mean, even in science, there is variation. For instance, if you want to interpret quantum mechanics, it depends on which tradition you subscribe to and the particular interpretations that you then validate. So presupposition or postulation. So presupposing certain aspects of reality, presupposing certain ontological entailments, and so on, we presuppose the ontology of what it is we're investigating, or we postulate the ontology of what it is we investigate based on the success, based on the empirical adequacy that we have achieved. Number two, the ontology does not seem to emerge from the theory itself. I don't want it to get too complicated, but there is no pathway from epistemology to ontology. Nobody in the history of philosophy has shown that pathway. Because once you epistemize it, where within that epistemological framework do you identify the ontology? That has always been the question, and nobody has been able to figure that out. Number three, science does not seem to employ any privileged access. This is a very key term, privileged access. Because for a long time, at least since the Enlightenment and so on, and you could probably comment on this, because I know you've done some studies on this. Since the Enlightenment and so on, there has always been this view, this received view of science, or this view of science that says that it has some sort of a privileged access to reality over and above the other disciplines. And that's why we have the social sciences, which are lesser than the exact sciences, physics, chemistry, and biology. Because there is some sort of privileged access that allows science to penetrate the ontological depths of reality that is just not available to the other disciplines. Is that really true based on some of the things that we have seen? Or is that something that is attributed to the sciences based on success and empirical adequacy? Now, we've got to start somewhere, right? After all is said and done, you know, the first thing that we see is that ontological entailment really is not something that we can verify, something that we can access, something that we have privileged access to in any discipline, much less the sciences. But that is not something that is bad. That is just the way in which we are designed and the ways in which we come to understand the world as epistemic agents. This is part of the limitations of our being in the world. So where do we begin? Where do we begin? Where did we begin in the dawn of civilization? Well, we began with some axioms. That's what it comes down to. I mean, we can look at different axiomatic systems, but it really did begin with axioms. What are axioms? Anyone? It's all up there. Fundamental truths that we take as the basis upon which we argue for other things.
Is axiom synonymous with assumption?
Yes, yeah. I mean, to some extent, yeah, to a large extent. but they're axioms are things that we don't prove. Axioms are things that we utilize to prove other things. We don't argue to axioms, we argue from axioms. Now, it'll take a lot of time to go into all of the details, but let me just, how many minutes? Oh, I only have about a minute. So let's look at axioms. Axioms are things that are taken to be true, but they cannot proven. They cannot be proven within the system. I'm relying on Gödel quite a bit for this definition. Things that are taken to be true, but it cannot be proven within the system. What are the foundations of mathematics? Axioms. What are the foundations of any area of knowledge? Axioms. We've got to begin somewhere. There is some base level where we've got to begin. Otherwise, nothing gets off the ground. Everything ultimately is axiomatic. What is another word for axiom? It can be assumption. It can be faith. Faith, things that we take to be true, but we cannot prove it within the system. And so in a very real sense, faith seems to be the foundation for knowledge. And faith seems to provide the hope of ontological entailment. In analytic philosophy, it's often talked about in terms of warrant. If I have a particular belief, what warrant do I have that it's true? You know, and the search in analytic philosophy has been for that quality called warrant. I propose that it's faith that provides the warrant. How can I be sure that what I believe is true as ontological entailment? Well, by faith, which gives me the hope that what I believe is in fact true. It's not because of some structure or some pathway that I've mapped out from what I believe from through an epistemological framework from epistemology to ontology. But I believe what I believe based on the revelation of God, based on what He has revealed in this world, and then by way of faith, I have that hope of that ontological entailment in the end. Thank you.
My philosopher's heart really enjoyed that. I suspect there might be some questions. So I'll open the floor now.
Of all the classic arguments for the existence of God, Thomas Aquinas.
Right. Five ways.
Anselm's pathological argument, which one do you find the most convincing?
Anselm's.
Like the ontological?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I like it. None of them are really convincing to me. Because the rationality of the existence of God and the actual existence of God are two very different things. You can have a rational case for something that is false. And so, what is rationally necessary might not be ontologically true. And so that's the whole problem. And that is why I kind of align myself with the Reformed epistemologists who make an argument against natural theology. Now, I'm very, very sympathetic to, like, for instance, Richard Swinburne's cumulative case argument and some of the evidentialist apologetics that has gone on. But the problem is this. First of all, evidence is theory laden. There is no generic way in order to build up a case just based on evidence, right? It's already colored and filtered through frameworks of reference. And so how do we make evidence convincing? Secondly, how much evidence is needed? It's person relative or system dependent, right? I mean, the principle of sufficient reason has the same issue, at least in my thinking. How much is sufficient? That becomes person relative, system dependent. And so a lot of these things can be utilized, but sparingly, because there is no generic access that we have. Everything is framed and constrained by our conceptual schemes and our conceptual frameworks.
I think that what you're saying is wonderful because, as kids, we have faith in our parents.
Right.
Or in our school teachers.
Right.
We just automatically believe they must be right.
Right.
And as we get older, our faith shifts from the simple faith we have in just our parents and so forth to I trust the journals that I read.
Right.
This is a good journal.
Right.
I'm trusting that the reviewers did their job.
And yeah.
When I see data,
Probably correct because
the journal, because the reviewers, but we don't know that.
Yeah.
It's not from our own investigation that we're trusting that.
Yeah.
That's a form of faith.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's actually the same thing that's happening theologically.
Yeah.
We're looking at things and say, well, I have seen this to be true.
Yeah.
And
so
I can build on that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a very good comment. A book I'd recommend is Born Believers by Justin Barrett. And one of the person who's probably very good at this is Mark Graves sitting in the back. So these are people that are good resources. Now, one of the things, I mean, we don't have a lot of time, and I'm really sorry for rushing through the presentation because I want to get out as much as possible within the limited time. But the problem is this, we have looked at history from the standpoint of rationality, but we have not looked at rationality from the standpoint of history. What is the buildup? What is the narrative within which conceptual developments happen in terms of how we reason, how we think? So for instance, how this works out in a practical way is that if your son or daughter comes home, let's say from college, and says, you know, I'm taking a physics class right now, and you know, I can't believe all this mumbo jumbo about God and faith and the Bible, because now I'm a scientist. Immediately we sit them down and we go through the five ways, or we go through the cosmological, teleological argument, all these things, argument from experience, moral experience, and so on. And none of those things are bad, but the problem is not a lack of evidence. The problem is the way in which they have framed the very concept of reason. See, they have been indoctrinated and inculcated into a framework that says only what is palpable, only what is empirical, only what is observable is true. And so if they subscribe to that particular version of reason, no amount of reasons that you offer them will convince them. So you've got to look at the conceptual framing within which everything happens, and within which everything is validated, and within which weight is assigned, and how all the evidence is rearranged and framed within that epistemological outlook. Oh, yeah.
yeah. Including his book, A Common Faith.
Yes.
He realizes when you think about intersubjective inquiry,
right.
He's very wary of ontological objectivity.
Right,
I mean, he's
right.
He's very wary of really
right.
going toward of what faith entails, but I
right.
think he offers resources for asking, instead of who has privileged access versus
right.
who doesn't,
right.
what kind of access are we talking about?
Right.
What is the
right.
quality of the
right.
inquiry?
Right.
What is the quality of community? And I think to me that is
yeah.
a linkage where for that student,
right.
it's you can study the history
right. Right.
of and not disparage science. Not
right.
disparage
right.
results.
Right.
Not disparage
exactly.
that, but be able to say what's the quality of the inquiry and how does that community hold itself to account?
Right.
And to that degree it
right.
applies to faith community.
Yeah. Yeah.
Applies to
yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I'm
and
wondering if you have reactions.
Yeah, no, and it redefines the apologetic endeavor. It's no longer about pure evidential apologetics or historical apologetics or cumulative case apologetics, because science is not the ideal with privileged access, so you somehow subscribe to science or become more scientific in order to find breathing room for theology within the academy. Now, if science has the same built-in limitations as the other disciplines, then science should be afforded the same kind of reverence as the other disciplines. So we're not disparaging science, but putting it in its proper place. And so it really redefines the apologetic engagement, so to speak. One of the person with Dewey, along with Dewey, and I hate to mention his name because his name, just at the mention of his name, you know, people kind of get negative, Richard Rorty. And he talks about how science does not have any final vocabulary. And so he's also been very influential, yeah.
One of the thoughts that crossed my mind when you were talking about axiom being an assumption, which is basically a faith, right? So would you think then for apologetic purposes, what you need to do is understand, well, what is this person's faith area, warrant,
right.
axiom, and then speak from there,
yes,
and
yes.
not necessarily external.
Yeah, so the person of science does not come to you as a person of reason, while a Christian comes to the dialogue as a person of faith. No, fundamentally, both are people of faith. The only question is, what do you have your faith in? And so we've got to point out some of the faith statements and the faith commitments that they themselves are making, thinking that they're being purely rational, because there is no such purely rational being on the earth. We are an integration of so many factors that we don't even understand, and faith is foundational to all these factors.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.